On this episode of China Unscripted, the Chinese Communist Party's psychological warfare against the U.S., how it successfully influenced presidents, Wall Street, and academia for decades, and how to start your own campaign to stop the Communist Party. Welcome to China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
And this episode of China Unscripted is sponsored by Surfshark. Surfshark is a VPN that can protect your privacy while you're using your computer, Android, or iPhone.
Like, for example, let's say you log into public Wi-Fi in Times Square. I don't know why you'd go there, but you want to check your email or your banking info. People can track that. Hackers can look into that. So that's why you got to use a VPN.
And for a limited time, you can get 83% off a two-year plan and an additional month free. Go to surfshark.deals/unscripted. Support the show. Joining us today is Grant Newsham, a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo. He was also a U.S. diplomat, business executive, and U.S. Marine Corps officer. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks.
So China influences the U.S. media, government, the entertainment industry, business, and I think we should tackle those one by one. But first, what's the big picture? I've heard some people just flat out say the Chinese Communist Party is at war with the United States. Would you say that's accurate?
Well, the Chinese Communist Party actually thinks so. They use words pretty much to that effect. You don't have to listen or to the Chinese media or read the Chinese media without getting some blood-curdling reference to killing 10,000 Americans in an afternoon to teach us a lesson and that sort of thing. So I think that's a fair statement. I don't think the United States has accepted that yet, except sort of in the last year or two.
What would that lesson be?
To bow down to the splendor of the Chinese Communist Party and the inevitable domination of the Chinese system as China rejuvenates itself.
It kind of reminds me of, beatings will continue until morale improves.
Oh, it kind of seems that way. But it really is striking, actually, when, even during the so-called golden era of U.S.-China relations, they back, some would argue in the 2000s or even into the 90s, that when U.S. businesses were falling over themselves to get into China, when you would still listen to what the Chinese were saying. As I say, if you just followed the media, even the English language media, it was not exactly nice. This is surprising that it took us so long to figure that out. And even then, there's plenty of people who refuse to believe it on our side.
But should we really be listening to what they say? I mean, isn't it kind of exaggerated?
Oh, well, that's what you hear. And there's an element of condescension in that. It reminds me of my mother, who used to talk about the way that Asians, she didn't use the word Asians, but how they jabber. Don't take them seriously, because they'll never be our equals. They're just so weird.
I say that about Shelley all the time.
Thanks, Chris.
I've heard that, but it's a condescending sort of take on the Chinese that, don't take them seriously. They're just children. They don't really mean it. Well, maybe they do. And certainly while we were humoring them, they've gone ahead and they've built up a military, which is certainly the fastest military buildup since World War II. And it's a Navy and an Air Force that could actually, in certain circumstances, take us on and probably do more than give us a run for our money.
Well, so you said the whole point of this lesson is to make people in the U.S. bow down to China. But it sounds like already a lot of businesses, politicians have already bowed down.
That's true. There's been probably about 30 years of U.S. industry and U.S. businesses, as I'd said, falling over themselves to get into China. It was seen as a place that was a gold mine. If you could sell one of something to every Chinese person, you'd get fabulously wealthy. Of course, the British were saying that in the 1800s as well. never quite worked out. But if you look at the flood of U.S. businesses, the top businesses, the Boeings, the Apple, Pratt & Whitney, Microsoft, even Motorola that I used to work for was the first big one to go in right after Tiananmen Square massacre. And they went in and committed suicide. But they've all gone in expecting to get rich, and it's never quite paid off. And then you have Wall Street and the financial companies, which have even been sort of more aggressive in trying to get into China. And they've, you know, it reminds you a little bit of a sea lion at a sea park who smells a bit of mackerel and will pretty much do anything to get to it. So if you go down the list, it's very hard to find a prominent American company that has not gone into the China market.
Well, I know I would do pretty much anything for mackerel, but I know you've called what China's doing to the U.S. a psychological operation or psychological warfare. For our audience who might not be familiar with these terms, what does that mean?
Well, you hear the word a lot, and you often referred to as psyops, and it sounds like something cool and esoteric. But it really just means manipulating something, somebody, so they think the way you want them to think and ultimately act the way you want them to act. Most people don't, they're not automatons, so whatever they do physically is the result of thinking. And if you can shape the way people think, then you can get them to act in the way that you want them to behave. And that's what is ultimately psychological operations is. You take advantage of the vulnerabilities that people have and the things that motivate them, and you carefully target those, and you can have a quite desirable result if you want. And I think when one steps back and looks at what the Chinese have accomplished against really the U.S. in the last 40 years, it's really been quite impressive.
Well, so it's like that TV show, The Mentalist, but on a large scale.
Kind of. You know, it's really nothing new. You know, it's not something that a sophisticated Western man figured out in the last 50 years, but rather it's been around, I would suspect, probably since caveman days. You read sort of Bible stories about Nehemiah rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, and that was. You had his enemies using psychological operations unsuccessfully. The Mongols were masters of it. So as I said, it's really nothing new, but it's nonetheless effective. And if you can succeed at it without having to fight a war, it's a lot less costly to get what you want.
I think that's the main takeaway from this: is it's war by other means. It's not troop on troop. Warfare, but warfare by other means. What do you think the goal is? What's China's goal?
Well, I think it's to have the ultimate, and we're talking about the Americans, so I'll just say the Americans, but it's really anyone that resists, and the Europeans come into this boat as well. But it's to have the Americans act or even not act so that the China gets a military, an economic, diplomatic, political, psychological advantage and superiority over the United States.
So what's an example of how they've been able to do this successfully in a specific industry or segment?
Well, I think we were talking about U.S. Business community, and what they have been able to do is they were able to lure in effectively U.S. businesses with the promises of opening up, with the liberalizing People's Republic of China. And you get everyone rushing in there to get to the market. So use Motorola's case. So they were the first the big company that came in after Tiananmen Square. And they were welcomed in by the Chinese government. The U.S. government actually encouraged them to go in because the idea was, well, if you get a big U.S. Company in there, particularly a very successful technology company, the company itself is going to do very well. But also the Chinese will see how Western business works, and it will transform the Chinese. But you had the Motorola go in with all their technology. They handed over a good chunk of it. What they didn't hand over was stolen. And what they did, while Motorola thought they were going to be successful, they effectively built up their competition. And you knew it was going to happen. You knew that within a decade, Motorola was going to have was going to face competitors in China who were making products that were as good as what Motorola makes, pretty much. And sometimes they're kind of the same thing, obviously. But they were a lot cheaper. And so they built up this domestic competition in China, and then they built up, which turned into a global competition. But throughout all this time, Motorola had convinced itself that it had to be in China. And it was going to get rich. There was this mirage that they had thought that Chinese people would be so happy just to have nice jobs at Motorola and then they would have more money and they could buy more Motorola products. But you had really diverging objectives. Motorola was thinking one thing, China was thinking another. But they created a dependence on the part of, say, Motorola that you see duplicated with every other company that's gone in just about. It's this psychological dependence on the Chinese market that causes the companies to, one, hand over technology, to accept discriminatory treatment, and to not complain about it. It's sort of this psychological browbeating that the Western companies have, because they're afraid if they complain, then they will lose their shot at the Chinese market because China will punish them. And it's this conditioning which has taken place that you see it repeated in the case of just about every company that goes in there. And you do hear people say, well, we made a ton of money. Well, that's the question is, over what period of time? And over the long term, it's not a very profitable market. It's a little bit like a casino. And you see an ad for a casino and you have happy people around the gambling table. And the better picture to take is at the end of the night when people are stumbling out of the casino where the faces aren't so happy. But you do see this, I say, throughout the – if you look at the experience of Western businesses which go into China, it's very similar in the – you look at the psychological effect on a company that goes in there.
Do you see – I mean, you said Motorola went in after the Tiananmen Square massacre, so – it's been almost 30 years of big U.S. and Western companies going into China and having the same thing happen to them. How come they're still doing it?
Well, shareholders don't complain is one reason, but they're all convinced that they're going to be the one to strike it rich. But also, if you consider it from a sort of a very senior business executive's perspective, he only needs to sort of last for a few years, maybe close one deal, and then he's done very well, and then it's somebody else's problem. It's almost a musical chairs aspect to it, that the idea is if you can get in and the thing doesn't come completely apart, and if you have some success, no matter how illusory, that you're going to do very well, salary-wise, bonus-wise, and you're going to go up in the company. There's a group mentality, and you do hear it a lot that, well, everyone else is there. You hear the expression a lot, well, we have to be in the China market. You know, you hear it over and over. And yes, yet one fairly asks, you know, you just wait for somebody to say, well, why do we have to be in the China market? What are the risks there? You know, it's a country that doesn't have a proper legal system where a contract means exactly what Xi Jinping says it means. It takes hostages. It discriminates against foreign companies. It steals your technology. Its intention, in fact, is to pretty much drive you out of business so a Chinese company can replace you. But with all of these risks and difficulties for a foreign company in China, you'd think, well, shouldn't somebody say do something differently? You know, but I'm still waiting for some senior representative from a major American company to say, you know, we cannot afford to be in China, but I still haven't heard it yet.
Well, so I've certainly heard the argument that by doing business with China, that will bring, as you said, liberalization. You know, as soon as Chinese people have more money, once they have cell phones in their pockets, they'll demand more freedoms. Democracy will come to China. Why did that never happen?
Well, I don't think the Chinese Communist Party ever intended that to happen. And that's probably the main reason. You know, once again, there was a sort of a condescending attitude towards the Chinese that, oh, they would really like to be like us. They're just not smart enough to be. And if we, but with exposure to us, then they'll like us and they will become a liberal democracy. It was basically like a science experiment that was based on a sort of a fallacy. And unfortunately, instead of reconsidering the hypothesis after a few years, Americans kept it going for about 40 years as well, since partly it was a sort of an attractive racket for a lot of people who got involved. Once again, it was a lack of clear thinking on the U.S. side, but as noted, I don't think the Communist Party ever had any intention. I was very happy to have Americans and other Westerners come into China and sort of offer technology, investment, and particularly that invaluable convertible currency that really keeps the Ponzi scheme running. But they also had the U.S. political class, U.S. official class, State Department, Department of Defense, you name it, all convinced that they had to accommodate China and that eventually China would, say, become like us, sort of like become like a really big Canada or something like that. But the Chinese were glad to have people think that. You know, everything that China did that was sort of expansionist or aggressive are not what we would want them to do. The Americans, the business community, the government, and even the U.S. military would back off because our thinking was, and the Chinese were glad to encourage it, that we just had to give them some more time, just had to let them see how the world works, how the rules-based order works, and then they'll say, get into our image. As I mentioned, the military used to see that thinking a lot, this idea of, well, if we just engage with China, if we show them how we are, that they'll understand how they should behave. Used to hear it a lot. It was reflected in the invitations of the Chinese military to the RIMPAC exercise in Hawaii, for example. All the while, the Chinese were breathing threatenings and slaughter against us and our friends in the region.
So where did the idea, that engagement idea, come from? Is it something that the U.S. or like other Western governments came up with, or think tanks, or was it from the Chinese Communist Party?
You know, that's a good idea. That's a good question. I don't know. You know, I don't know where it emerged from. I imagine there's probably not too many people these days who want to take credit for it, but I really don't know when it appeared. It's sort of like this virus now in China. People would like to know where it came from, but nobody quite knows.
I wonder if it stems from, you know, there were people essentially arguing the same thing with the Soviet Union. If it didn't begin with China, it just began with this whole dealing with the communist Soviet bloc.
Well, I think you've got a good point there. There was against the Soviet Union, there was an idea, well, that the Russians only act the way they do because they're afraid of us. And if we show them that they have nothing to be afraid of, then they will behave the way we want them to behave. And that it sounds a little bit like the, you know, the quote by, I think, Professor Joseph Nye, that if you want China to be an enemy, treat them like an enemy. And which the follow-on on that is, okay, then accommodate them in everything they do and never challenge them. But that wasn't all that long ago, maybe 25 years ago. But I think you're right that it does reflect an idea that goes back a long time. And once again, in our thinking that, you know, if people really do want to be nice, and if they're not nice, then we must be doing something wrong. And if you're the opponent, well, you'd love to have the Americans in this case thinking that, and all you have to do is keep them thinking that. you know, with the promise or the illusory promise that you're going to open up, you know, which you hear all the time, really from the 80s. So that it seems like every quarter, the Chinese Communist Party or some leader announces that China is going to open up. Well, they've been opening up for about 30 plus years now, and it doesn't seem like you think they'd have been opened up pretty well by now, but it doesn't seem to have happened.
You mentioned earlier that there are ways that the Chinese Communist Party kind of encourages this type of thinking. Can you talk about that?
One thing that they're very good at is, I would call it sort of hospitality diplomacy. It works really well with Westerners. If you invite them to China, give them a banquet, tell them how much you like them, just show them a really good time. You'll find that Americans will come back thinking, well, these are great people. You know, this is a just a wonderful system, a wonderful place, and let's take it easy on them. You know, we really want, they want to be our friends. We just don't understand each other. So America has to double its efforts on that. You see that, oddly enough, you even see it within the U.S. military, that you would find, until very recently, you'd find very senior officers, generals and admirals, would go over to China and engage with their counterparts. And they would have this, this wonderful, alcohol-fueled feast, and they would get a nice show and tell, and they'd come back thinking that they understood China, that there was really nothing to worry about with the Chinese. And then which was, of course, mistaken, but then even better, after retirement, some of these guys have gotten into the sort of the track two system of meetings with their retired Chinese counterparts, which is a nice five-star hotel, first-class air travel over to China for a series of meetings, and then they'll come back. So it is that hospitality that works very nicely, but also the promises or the allure of a lot of money if you see things the Chinese way.
Well, why wasn't that seen as a national security risk? Why didn't the government stop that?
But you can't say that, because China would get angry. You know, we need their help with global warming, transnational crime, North Korea, et cetera, et cetera. That's part of it. But part of it is everybody was, or so many people were on the take. You know, if you are a business, you're, that is what you want, is to make money. I don't want to accuse, certainly serving government officials, the money wasn't really an angle. There was more sort of a vanity that they were going to be the uniquely sort of understanding of China and could shape U.S. policy for the best interests of the United States, even if they benighted everybody else, couldn't understand the nuance of their approach. But certainly in the business community, the China hand community, that the people do very well, actually, with financially, dealing with China. So there's a money angle, vanity, naivete, just hubris, ultimately, a sense that, we're better than these people, and we'll be glad to take some money from them. And you can, when money's involved, I worked with a Wall Street firm for a long time. When money's involved, people can convince themselves of just about anything. And if there's a lot of money involved, they can convince themselves even easier. So it really is some really age-old sort of aspects of human nature that the ancient Greeks knew very well, that are on display, and that the Chinese communists have, to their credit, have been taken advantage of, in our case. And as noted, it's been on a very wide front. There's nobody really who escapes sort of blame for this. And I mentioned the U.S. military, I've had the academic class, the political class, government officials, American industry, Wall Street, and I don't know who I've left out there, but you can find cases from all of those.
Oh, Hollywood, of course. Hollywood.
Oh, they Yes, indeed. You know, you look at Tom Cruise's jacket or flight jacket in the latest Top Gun. It's missing the Taiwan flag. That tells you, and that's just one. That's just an obvious example. And you will hear it. Well, we make so much money from China, and you know, for a an industry that allegedly has some principles, I think it's a pretty good case study into what the price of principles are, which is a lot of tickets being sold in the People's Republic of China.
Well, I know you wrote that Hollywood practically gives the word whoredom a bad name.
I did write that, and it's I was probably going a little easy on them, but
wow.
To put it, you know, not being, you know, this is, you know, an industry that, you know, talks about, you know, principles and dignity and human freedom, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they ought to go hold the Academy Awards out in East Turkestan, out in western, the western part of that of China, where they have concentration camps. Apparently, the word means something different these days, but than it did in the 1930s or the 1940s when people said never again. Which is, it's once again, if you track it back to the thinking involved here, that for whatever reasons, you know, money, once again, you know, vanity, naivete, that you have Americans who should know better, who have convinced themselves that China is different. You know, if a similar, you recall South Africa, that the self-righteousness that was, you know, that's when we're looking at it, but it looks like self-righteousness now. But just how worked up, you know, Hollywood and many other parts of U.S. society were about what was going on in apartheid South Africa. China has something similar, and yet now nobody says a word. You know, and these are not, we're not talking about dumb people here. They're intelligent. Yet they're, you know, have certainly managed to contort their thinking to overlook some pretty horrific things that you think they should know better about.
Well, how do you think the U.S. media has done at raising awareness about Chinese Communist Party influence in the United States?
I think China Uncensored's done pretty well. But the,
why,
the,
thank you.
Okay, well, I couldn't resist. But the
I'm glad you didn't.
Well, yes. But in general, not very well. You know, the... You look at, particularly if you'd look at it over, say, a 30-year period, then you'd really have to say not very well at all. You know, there have been, of course, excellent, sort of a lot of good reporters, you know, around, like John Pomfret of Washington Post, James Mann. There have been good individual reporters who've done some excellent reporting. But at the editorial level or the corporate level, there hasn't been really a willingness on the part of too much media to actually call China out for what it's been doing, either in China or in the United States. And you will these days, say within the last couple of years, you will read some sternly worded editorials in, say, the Washington Post, New York Times, et cetera. But at the same time, they're taking sort of paid – they're taking money from the Chinese Communist Party to kind of deliver or to insert the China Daily, sort of a China propaganda piece into their papers, and which is it's hard to understand the logic there. But it, once again, if there's money to be had, it does tell you something. But in general, the media has not done a very good job of this. You know, I'd point out, you know, for example, you had Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who, you know, once said that, well, in a past life, she must have been Chinese. And you know, she's been very accommodating to the PRC over a number of years. Her husband's made a ton of money doing business there. And she, you know, had effectively a Chinese spy on her payroll for a long while in a very responsible position. And this sort of thing, how much attention did it get? It, you know, any good reporter could have tracked this down and put two and two together a long time ago. It sort of broke a few years ago, or fairly recently, but it had a very short shelf life. And then it was just back to business as usual. But you are seeing more reporting about so Chinese influence operations, but it really isn't a sort of a priority, it seems. You know, is my is sort of how it struck me over the years. I say there's been some periodic attention paid to it, and you, as I said, you do have some excellent reporters who've been written on China over the years, but the media itself has gotten into the, well, you can't complain about China, otherwise, we'll lose money, or even our reporters will have more trouble in doing their jobs in China. And one classic example of, since we're on the media, is it was about 2013 when Bloomberg actually, like one of those, a couple of their reporters did an excellent report on the overseas wealth of China's leaders, including Xi Jinping. And I think the New York Times was in on it as well, but Bloomberg is the one that immediately comes to mind. And the Chinese Communist Party leadership, of course, went berserk, and they blocked the websites of the U.S. Media outlets. And in Bloomberg's case, it also threatened Bloomberg's potentially money-making other operations in China. So Bloomberg spiked the story. But it was a very well-done story, very well-researched, and it was correct by all accounts. And the done by some diligent reporters, and there are some good local editors who supported it. But at the at a certain level, the kibosh was put on it. And that is it's an excellent case study, if you do want to see just how the U.S. media has backed off and pooled its punches. And it's not an impressive story, to my way of thinking.
And now Bloomberg's running for president of the United States.
You did. There is a that does get one's attention, to say the least. But put yourself in China's position, in the Chinese Communist Party's position, and well, things are looking pretty. You know, if somehow he does have, you know, say he should win, but even if he doesn't. You know, this is Michael Bloomberg, who is a prominent American with a lot of influence, a lot of money, and you know, he has shown himself willing to back off if the Chinese threaten the money flow. He was, in December, I think it was back in Beijing with his New Economy Forum or such like, where these big hitters from the U.S. get together with the Chinese top dogs and, you know, really have meetings and talk about what they're going to do. And this is, you know, if you think about it from a political warfare standpoint, this really doesn't look very good. I think Hank Paulson, the former head of Goldman Sachs, was there as well. And former U.S. Secretary of Treasury. So you have these, once again, if you look at it from a psychological operations perspective, that the Chinese have done very well in getting some Americans who should know better to think that America really does need to accommodate China, to meet them halfway. And one wonders what on earth was being said in the 1930s. You know, probably something similar.
Jeez, how deep does Chinese communist influence go in the United States?
Pretty deep. You know, I've mentioned academia, which has gotten itself hooked on Chinese students paying full tuition. You have, once again, U.S. government officials. You know, jaw-dropping example, you had a woman who was a year or two ago was the senior Asia Pacific official at the U.S. State Department. She retired after she didn't get the top job, the permanent position as the head of Asia Pacific, owing to people in Congress thought she was too soft on China. But she afterwards went to Shanghai, spoke to a group that included Chinese Communist Party officials, and told them, "Well, just wait until a new administration comes in, and they'll ease up on you." So here you have someone who was right at the top of U.S. Asia policy, goes to Asia, goes to China, and actually counsels them on how to sort of get around what the current U.S. administration is doing to China. That should tell you something. When you have National Basketball Association officials and players prostrating themselves when one of the official executives at the Houston Rockets puts in a good word for the people in concentration camps or such like. And so you have our sporting class, you know, who...
Oh, you mean Hong Kong.
That's right. My mistake. I was mistaking my oppression. But it was human. It was Hong Kong. And in short order, you had players and executives going out, on our side, going after them, the self-censorship, there's obviously a financial angle to that. Now, I said you had a commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, one or two back, who declared that his biggest concern was not the People's Republic of China or the People's Liberation Army and its Navy that was even at that point was pretty scary, but rather was climate change. You had in the Pacific Command, in fact, you could not even say that China was an adversary. And I didn't say enemy. You could not even refer to them as an adversary. So that's the U.S. military, the people who are really supposed to be on the ball and pretty tough. Wall Street, you can read the financial analysis of the China market. Just go back, say, 20 years and see how many times that anyone makes a reference to the usefulness of, say, doing business in a market with a proper legal system, property rights, and respect for individual liberty and human rights that we would value. You won't find it very often at all. So there's your financial class. The business classes, we've talked about that already. So it does go, it's pretty deep. And if you look at the individual presidents, just walk that back. And that too is a sort of a horrifying story. The Obama administration, that was the one where you could not refer to China as anything but a friend. The head of intelligence for the Pacific Command was back in 2015 or so, 14-15, who did say that China was looking for a short, sharp war. I'm told the White House absolutely despised him. And when they asked for his head, U.S. Senior officers in Hawaii were willing to give it before. So that was the Obama administration. The Bush administration before that didn't have the stomach for taking on China. It had too many problems of its own making in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Clinton administration, my goodness, they if there was ever proof that you'll do things for money. The Clintons were it. There's an excellent book called Year of the Rat by William Triplett that lays it out in such detail that, and I'm a lawyer, but it's it lays it out, and it really it's almost a prosecutor's brief for how Chinese influence worked in the Clinton administration, and really how they hit that sort of grand slam of getting China into the World Trade Organization. George H.W. Bush before that, he had spent 15 months in China, so he knew these people. He excused the Tiananmen Square massacre, even sent them the Chinese leadership a fawning letter, which if you read it, it really gives a whole new meaning to the word fawning, telling them that, no problem, we can get over this, and, we love you guys. So if you go, but this is, and it's hard to get much higher in the U.S. than the presidency. And that's, it's, they've all, even going back to Ronald Reagan, they've had their shortcomings. And, when it comes to dealing with China, and once again, it's the thinking that that's important. And they've all managed to convince themselves for whatever reason, that, an accommodationist approach to China is the right one. And it was, I think, clear a long time ago that we really needed to try something different.
Would you say that the psychological warfare that the Chinese Communist Party has been able to do kind of starts at that individual level that you were talking about and then turns into groupthink? Or are they doing it at like multiple levels at the same time?
Oh, it's like getting... it's like walking out into a snowstorm or a rainstorm. You're getting hit from every direction. You really have to admire the scale of it, the multi-directional approach and really down to very low levels as well. You know, when they're trying to sort of win over farmers in the American Midwest, you know, that's one thing. When you're trying to get a former U.S. Secretary of Treasury on your side, which is really easy, that's very different. And then academia, when you're hosting U.S. military officers, it really is something that, you know, is so sort of widespread, as I said, multi-directional, and it takes different forms. You know, it can be hospitality. It can be inviting people to their scholars to China, you know, with, once again, a nice sort of handsome hotel and a business class ticket, etc. There's funding for U.S. think tanks. Really, if you go down the list, it's, really is, is probably, I would say, the most effective psychological operation campaign maybe in history, say, when you look at the scope of it. And it's not just the United States, where you see it at all levels of society, all levels of business and academia, etc., but other countries as well. You know, you go to, like, the Third World or, say, Ethiopia, Angola, et cetera, just South America. There's Chinese everywhere. And it's important, it's useful, I found, to look at Chinese investment overseas, not just for the economic angle, but really for consider the psychological aspect to it, where it creates a dependency and it tends to split whatever society it gets into, where it creates a constituency, creates a class that suddenly has an interest in doing what China wants. It's often a financial interest, but that will then manifest itself in the political behavior of the country, and it will do things that we would rather not have them do.
Well, this sounds like an absolute nightmare, but what I notice is everything the Communist Party is doing is, I guess, technically not illegal. So how do you combat this? Because I don't think people want necessarily another McCarthyism. But how do you combat this when they're essentially using the free and open society of the United States to destroy the free and open society of the United States?
Oh, a good bit of it, I think, would... a good approach, one, is to do your own political warfare, you know, which the U.S. hasn't done it very well since the Cold War. But a lot of this with exposure, that tends to have a bracing effect. And particularly when you have for politicians who have been pretty easy on China, when you realize that they do have some sort of financial angle to it, say exposure is one thing, and that can get you a ways. But you also do need to there's other things you can do. You know, one example would be it's gotten some attention, some good press attention, is the so-called Confucius Institutes that were at a lot of U.S. universities, which were allegedly Chinese language was being taught, but the Chinese Communist Party had the final say over what was taught and what topics were not discussed, et cetera, et cetera. So essentially propaganda mills at U.S. universities that the Chinese were also paying for. But what the U.S. government did is say, well, if you're going to have a Confucius Institute, then you cannot you're not going to get U.S. government funding or something along those lines. So that's one approach to it. Additionally, as I said, the exposure aspect, if we could actually enforce the Foreign Agents Registration Act so that require people to put themselves down as really Chinese propagandists, that would probably upset a lot of people in Washington, D.C., but that's one approach to it. Another would be, once again, if you look at the psychological effect of Chinese money that it's had on Wall Street and buying up U.S. companies or listing U.S. companies, listing Chinese companies on the U.S. exchanges. Now, this has actually prompted the Securities and Exchange Commission and the New York Stock Exchange to allow Chinese companies to list, even though they don't meet the standards that an American company would have. China says, well, if we gave you the accurate information, that's a national secret. We can't do that. So what the U.S. could do is you could say, well, you're welcome to operate it, to come here and enjoy our markets, but you're going to have to act just like an American company. You think, well, don't we do that? Well, the short answer is no, we don't. You could have forced our laws would be one start, and even just reciprocal treatment. That would undercut a lot of the economic damage, the economic end of the Chinese political warfare. You can tighten the requirements for particularly national security reasons on Chinese investments into the United States. That has been done a little bit with this administration. In fact, this administration has done more than most all the others put together as well. The U.S. could, say no more engagement or beyond the absolute necessary between the U.S. military and China. That's, in fact, in one of the most important things that you can do, it does require an admission that China, run by the Chinese Communist Party, is at least an adversary. And if you listen to the Chinese, it's an enemy that is hell-bent on driving us out of Asia, for starters, and to make life as miserable as possible for our friends in the region as well. And it really, when a country or a people actually do sort of wake themselves up like a drunk guy coming out of his slumber and say, we're not going to do this. We're not going to put up with this. We're going to bite back. That alone tends to have a bracing effect throughout the entire system. And that effectively is what the Trump administration has done, to its great credit. It is, it's really done nothing more than say, I'm going to fight back. It's a lesson that a lot of people learned in the schoolyard, that if you look like you're going to defend yourself, you're not going to have as many problems as otherwise. So that there is that sort of so-called sea change in sort of U.S. behavior or the approach to China that say it has a positive effect throughout everything we do. There's no one solution to all of this, but it does start with a willingness to get up on your hind legs and then to really expose this sort of the gravy train that too many people have benefited from, to put officials in who do see that it is important to take on China and actually stand up for U.S. interests. To support our allies is particularly important. And then with U.S. business, it'd be nice to see something like a South Africa-style divestment campaign, against China that did so much damage to the South African economy. It would be nice to see a movement like that on college campuses, for example. So there's a number of things that we can do, some legal, some sort of moral, some just informational. But all based on the sort of an awareness or at least a change that if we don't do something, we are going to find ourselves in a lot more trouble than we are at the moment.
Well, you mentioned a lot of things the U.S. can do, but what can the people listening do to make the U.S. do those things?
Well, that's always the good question is, okay, now how do we do it? Well, you do find that congressmen do listen. You can actually be vocal about this, this stuff. They do listen to what constituents say. You can, particularly if you're shareholders, and there's different, some shareholders are more equal than others, but one would love to see an annual meeting at one of these companies where somebody stands up and says, please explain, why are we doing business in a country or in a market that, as I noted, which doesn't have a proper legal system, which is out to destroy you, which has concentration camps, for crying out loud. So there is a financial angle that you can apply in a corporate sense. As noted, just speaking up about it to one's elected officials is one way. It'd be nice to be... with the Hong Kong protests, just even the moral support which which people can give in whatever way they can do it, that does make a big difference. It has a cumulative effect. It would be nice to have, you know, even if students listening, to take on the, you know, if they're not hearing, if all they're hearing from in their classes is, well, we have to placate China, we have to accommodate them, we don't want to treat them like an enemy, or we just might have one. It'd be nice to see students actually doing their homework and actually pointing out that this is a sort of an aggressive, rapacious regime that does not treat its people nicely at all.
You know, actually, on that note, we recently did some investigation into the fact that China is essentially manufacturing all of the maps of the world. And what you see is a lot of globes and educational maps being printed in China, showing China's version of global borders, including the Nine Dash Line, Taiwan as a province of China, some of the Indian border belongs to China. So that's a way that, like, if students see this, they should raise their hand in class and be like, hey, this is propaganda in our textbooks.
Yeah, you know, that really is the, you know, is an important thing. I'd mentioned the anti-apartheid South Africa campaign, and you think about the effect that had. That was a grassroots movement that, you know, ultimately brought that system down. And then you have people who are alleged to be environmentalists. Well, take on the leading polluter. Take on the country that's sweeping the seas of fish. Go after China. You know that there are things that, you know, where you do, people can sort of get in a blow and actually do something useful in that. The military itself. It'd be nice to see sort of more. It's surprising just how often you will come across younger officers who don't realize that China is in fact out to harm us. You know, it'd be nice even they. If a lot of this comes down to doing one's homework. That would be a useful approach. And one thing I will note, and it's important to point out, because I do make it sound like everyone in the United States has been sort of hoodwinked by Chinese psychological operations, but that's not true. You do find that in Washington and on Capitol Hill, there's always been a lot of congressmen and staff members and other officials who have always understood the PRC and have had no illusions about it. And they've done their best to try and keep us from giving away the game. This goes back to the Taiwan Relations Act after President Carter sold out Taiwan. But the Congress passed this act to force the president and a future president to not be able to leave Taiwan adrift, but to have to support it. So say there have always been people that, you know, really have known what needs done towards China, but they've been fighting a holding action, but now they're have gotten some momentum, and those are you know, a few things that one can do, but it's not one simple thing, but also, as I'd mentioned, it'd be nice if someday, you know, in my lifetime, the United States government actually learned to put in a good word for democracy and for our ideals and do some decent political warfare. But we really haven't done that all that well. And it is important as well to, you know, if you are going to try and take on this Chinese psychological warfare, particularly overseas, you have to provide an alternative. You can't just tell, you know, some country somewhere, you know, don't do business with the Chinese and without providing an alternative. And that's where, you know, we'd like to see the government, the U.S. government, you know, ideally combined with some thoughtful businessmen, actually say provide that alternative, and that's a piece of the puzzle, which doesn't get mentioned all that often.
Well, great. That's a lot of good information that doesn't make me feel very happy about the world, which I feel is how most of these podcasts go.
I was actually thinking of how much people can do, because. Right, like if you have students at schools who are raising issues about academics going to China for conferences, or the influence of the Chinese consulate on Chinese student groups, that's something students can do. Mm-hmm. Environmentalists can raise, you know, issues of Chinese pollution, of Chinese overfishing in developing countries. You know,
Get Greta Thunberg to talk about China.
It's even a social justice issue in the sense that the people who have been hurt and marginalized most by China's like fishing operations are like the locals and the native people in all these countries, whether it's Kiribati or Mauritania. So there's all these different interest groups in the United States who have totally different perspectives on things, but who could come together and start to raise awareness about these problems.
Wow, that actually made me feel much better.
Well, you know, the game's not over. You know, it may be the bottom of the seventh and we're down by four or five, but it's not over yet. Also, one thing you can do is if you really want to go see China, go to Taiwan. If you want to see the beach. You know, that is, and I say I'm not really joking. It's the more support that is given to Taiwan and even just going to see the place, that is key to everything, to my way of thinking, that it does give a lie to this idea that Chinese people can only sort of be governed with a boot on the neck. You know, well, what's this election that they have and human rights and liberties that they have 90 miles across the ocean? But so if you want to learn Chinese, well, go learn it in Taiwan. That would be, as I say, one thing, that's one avenue of approach that is worth pursuing.
Well, it's great. Thank you so much for joining us today, Grant. If somebody listening wants to know more about you or read some more of your writings, where can they go?
I write a lot for, they can Google me and that'll produce a lot of things, but I write a lot for Asia Times, and I also write for a newish outlet called And Magazine, AND Magazine, the National Interest, but I'm here and there, anywhere I can get somebody to listen to me. But say if you Google me, that'll be a good start, but Asia Times is what I'm usually associated with.
Well, great. Thanks again for joining us. I hope people listening are inspired to take action. Always fun to hear about how the United States is losing a war it didn't know it was in.
I kind of felt like instead of psychological warfare, we should just call it money warfare. It's like everything comes down to the fact that people are incentivized to make money or be given money it's depressing.
I think the funny thing is that, you know, Grant Newsham was saying, oh, well, the U.S., you know, people are condescending towards China, thinking we can make China reform. Meanwhile, the Chinese officials are condescending towards America, thinking that they can influence us.
One of those things was correct.
Yeah.
I don't know how to feel about that.
The Chinese are so simplistic, and yet it's like Americans being bought off with like a big dinner.
Well, I mean, Americans are equally intelligent, but I think that the Chinese Communist Party has figured out how to take advantage of our greed, and they've really used that and twisted it. So, yeah, I mean, money warfare is essentially a great summation of this.
That's so sad. I don't know.
And actually, the other side of that is, like, with, like, our shows, like, it's so difficult for us to make any money. So it also disincentivizes people to go against the system because there's no money in it.
Yeah, but fortunately, like, for example, I got sponsorship to go to an academic conference in China, and I'm flying business class. So, you know, I think that's going to turn out great.
Matt is the turncoat.
Shelley, Matt's been bought off. Let's put him out of his misery.
I think also the Chinese Communist Party has managed to target the one person on our team that would destroy our show if he was not a part of it.
What are you talking about? I'm arguably the least important of the three of us.
Oh, because Chris and I both picked you if we were stranded on a desert island.
Yeah, but if they bought me off as the face of the show,
that would be arguably much worse. I mean, like, sure, I set up the podcast equipment, but I think losing Chris,
I feel like we could go on.
Chris is the face of the show, and you're the humor ninja, also accuracy ninja. So I don't think we could do it without both.
We are a triumvirate. We are more than the sums of the parts.
So you're saying we're three emperors ruling Rome together? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Shouldn't we fight a lot more then?
Don't we?
I've just been subtly undermining both of you for years, and you just haven't realized it.
No, we've been undermining you, haven't we, Chris?
I'm sort of a get along with people kind of guy. I don't know. I think you two are the psychos. All right. Well, thanks for listening. Again, this episode of China Unscripted is sponsored by Surfshark. When you go online, everything you do is being tracked and logged by the websites you visit and by your internet service provider, and in many cases, the government. And if you're in a country that tries to control everything you say and do, you should definitely be using Surfshark to protect your identity. It allows you to go around the government's firewall to access the free and open internet. VPNs like Surfshark are how listeners in China are able to access this show. Surfshark also has a clean web mode, which protects you from ads, trackers, and malware. Plus, you can connect as many devices as you want. Try it out with a 30-day money-back guarantee. We have a special URL for our China Unscripted listeners. Go to surfshark.deals/unscripted. For a limited time with that URL, you can get 83% off a 2-year plan and an additional month free. This offer makes your subscription just $1.91 per month. And again, that covers as many devices as you want. So, check out Surfshark. Thanks again for listening. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
Talk to you next time.